Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Coming up this week in Madison, there's going to be a public lecture from our guest this hour. It's by the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. And our guest has done a great deal of work on violence, war, early sexuality, commercials, media culture, and their effect on young people in our society. Professor Diane Levin is the author of So Sexy, So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids. She's an internationally recognized expert in early childhood development, and she'll be talking at this lecture and workshop about age-appropriate strategies to counter the assault. Her presentation gives parents the information, skills, and confidence to discuss sensitive topics openly and effectively so children can just be children. She's a professor of education at Wheelock College in Boston, where she's been training early childhood professionals for over 25 years. She teaches courses on play, violence prevention, action research, and a summer institute on media literacy. And she does an annual service learning program to Belfast on how early childhood programs can help communities affected by conflict heal. Lessons from Northern Ireland. She is with us this hour. She's done all kinds of projects, including the PBS Parents Websites, A Parent's Guide to Girls, talking with children about the news, talking to kids about war and violence, How to Raise a Child Who Cares, and the PBS Parent's Guide to School. And she is the founder of Teachers Resisting Unhealthy Children's Entertainment, which prepares materials to help parents deal with the media and commercial culture in their children's lives. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Diane. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. She's speaking this Thursday at Memorial High School Auditorium in Madison, and there will be a youth worker and teacher gathering on Friday. And on Saturday, early childhood training. Diane, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be with you and to be in Madison soon.
Yeah, you'll have a good time and people will welcome you. I'm sure. I was getting my hair cut last week and they just got the latest edition of People magazine, which has a picture, as you probably know, of a very young girl in one of these beauty pageants. And I looked at it and I looked through the magazine because you always do that. Well, many of us do. We don't normally read this, but when you're at the beauty parlor, you tend to look at this, what's going on with stars. And I wondered as I was looking at it, are they just making something, really big of something that's very, very small? Or is this something that we need to pay attention to?
Well, that's a good question and has multiple answers. But the idea that, I assume you're talking about the three-year-old dressed as a prostitute and the four-year-old, a prostitute star from a movie, and a four-year-old who was dressed as Dolly Parton with a padded bra.
There's
a few things. One is the TV show, and I'm not sure if we can mention it, but the TV show that did it is out to get publicity no matter how they can get it. Because they know, as marketers do, that any publicity is good.
Really?
Yes. So it gets people talking about them. There's a buzz out there. The number of people that have asked me about it because they know about my work, just colleagues and friends I meet on the street. It's quite amazing the buzz it has created. So that they are doing it not because of the well-being of children, but to create the buzz, to perpetuate their show, to get audience for their advertisers and make money.
Mm-hmm.
But when we think of the children, I worry about those two particular girls who were dressed up like that at 3 and 4 and their parents' attitudes. So, well, it's just fine. They think it's cute. They're nice kids. I love them. They love me. But what worries me the most is the model it creates for other young children who see it. And children are drawn to salient, dramatic, extreme things. That's why things get more extreme on shows all the time in terms of sexualization. But it also means that children then, because they're drawn to it, think, well, I want to try that out. Maybe I should be like that. If someone else looks like that, that's who's the popular one, who I want to be my friend. So there's a whole kind of trajectory set up to make little girls focus on appearance, want to buy more things to look right, become consumers, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more during the time, a whole range of other things.
I can understand, because it's a capitalist system, the idea to get people to buy more things. But what's the sexual aspect of all of this? Why do you want people to buy things that will make you, at an inappropriate age, be sexual?
Right. A good question there, too. And the shortest answer that I can give you is that I think what's happening is it's not sex that we're talking about when a 3 or 4 year old is dressed like this. It's sexualization. It's a kind of being sexy, focusing on appearance that lures kids, girls, into saying by the time they're in middle school, many girls say their favorite activity is shopping.
Great.
Now, why is that? Instead of engaging in the world, instead of getting satisfaction from other things, it's kind of this surface structure shopping to look right. And when I was writing So Sexy So Soon, as you mentioned in your introduction, I had done a lot of work on children and violence. And I've looked at how violence is marketed to boys through Transformers, et cetera, Power Rangers. And what's going on is that from at a very early age, children then are looking at those images for themselves and developing ideas about how they're supposed to be, how they're supposed to play, what they're supposed to be like. And writing about violence was quite easy. It was easy. You could say violence is bad. The world may not be doing a good job dealing with it, but we want to try to find ways to solve our problems without fighting. What can we do? You can't say sex is bad. It's a much more complicated issue we're dealing with. And my breakthrough was realizing children, we want them to learn how to have caring, connected relationships when they're young, so that when they grow up, they can have caring and connected relationships in which sex is a part. But the fact is now, learning how to have relationships, which is one of the tasks of childhood, how do you perspective take? How do you learn what you can do to help somebody else? How do you get people to help you to meet your needs? That kind of relationship building is getting undermined as more and more children are judging each other by how they look.
Mm-hmm.
And so marketers have known that and focus on looking. I've been studying kind of this issue of marketing for the last 25 years or more when television was deregulated in the middle 80s and TV could be used to market products to children for the first time. And gender divisions were used to market. For boys, we had He-Man, Masters of the Universe. We had Transformers. We had and Ninja Turtles, G.I. Joe, and those were all violent toys. And that's when I started hearing from teachers they were having trouble with war play and kids obsessed with it. And they were getting toys that said, when you play, you imitate the violence you saw on the screen, because the toys were exact replicas of what they saw. Whereas for girls, it was being pretty. It was My Little Pony, Care Bears, Rainbow Bright. They did well, but not nearly as well as violence. And eventually they figured out fashion was the way to reach girls.
Hmm.
And so it's a long process, but the net result is it's harder and harder. We hear about more bullying and teasing. We hear about all kinds of things that point to the fact that children now are having a harder time developing empathy and being bullish and teasing, and choosing your friends by how they look is more and more common.
Tell me about the studies, compare if you would for me, the studies that you've done on the effects of media on young people in this country and the effects of actual violence that young people see in the streets in places like Belfast, which I know that you've done workshops there for a long, long time. Is it a similar thing, or is actual violence much, much worse?
Well, I see it as a continuum of violence. So, we start at the bottom with kind of entertainment violence that's saying violence is fun, violence is exciting, violence is what you do to have a good time, and grown-ups make TV shows and toys that they give to you so you can act it out and have fun with it. And then at the next level, going up the continuum, is violence, real violence children hear about in the news, And say after September 11th, I did a lot of work on how kids were hearing about what happened with the bombing, with the planes, and the people who were hurt. But a lot of children would then use what they had heard in entertainment media to try to interpret it. So, for instance, a child would say, "I sure hope we have the Power Rangers there to fight them. We really need them." I mean, that wasn't every child. But then kids hear about it, but there were kids who were quite scared about what happened. And when they'd see a man with a beard, there were children who would get upset because they saw pictures of Osama bin Laden. And if children are getting both news and entertainment, then it's worse. And then you have children who experience some violent, isolated trauma around violence. They see a crime, they are in some way victim of a crime, someone near them is affected by a crime, and those children are even more affected, and we know they can affect you for your whole life, post-traumatic stress disorder. But those kids often will use, again, what they hear about in the world and what they see on the screen to help interpret those experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the top, we have children who live in communities where there's chronic violence. And that can be in Belfast during the Troubles and the parts of the Northern Ireland that were most affected. It can be children in war zones. It can be children in communities, urban communities in the U.S. that have high levels of crime and violence. And those children are the most affected. And it's the fewest number. So as we go up that continuum, there are fewer kids, but they're more affected. But the kids at the most affected level are often poorer kids with families with fewer resources and more risk factors in their lives. And they end up, spending the most time looking at screens.
Mm-hmm.
With the violence on it, having the least supervision, seeing it. And we know even from looking at entertainment violence, there are examples of kids who have experienced post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about, because I have a special interest in Belfast. Tell me more about these programs that you do, the service learning program in Belfast
each
year.
Wonderful. I would love to talk about that.
Great.
I have been doing work there for about 7 years since the peace process was well underway, and when they were beginning a program to work with very young children at the preschool level about the stereotypes they were learning about Catholics and Protestants, good guys and bad guys, and because the research that came out just at about then by someone named Paul Connolly in Belfast at Queen's University, was showing that children as young as 3 were able to identify this color flag is mine, that's the bad guys, for the Catholic, for the Protestant, for the British flag, for the Protestants in Northern Ireland were primarily focused on, and the Irish, the Republic of Ireland flag that the Catholics were primarily focused on. Kids knew what colors were for them based on their religious group. So they decided to start at very early ages on the stereotypes the children were developing, and they actually developed a whole curriculum with almost child-sized puppets that had happy and sad faces. One had a Catholic-identified name and colors in his clothes, and the other had Protestant-identified red, white, and blue for the British. And that puppet's clothes, and they could have happy or sad faces. And then they did something that was totally unique. They developed, it shows that I don't think all media is bad. They developed public service announcements, 1-minute PSAs, that were aired on Irish, Northern Irish television, that showed these children being scared of each other, having some situation where they had to work together, and then they were friends afterwards. So that parents saw the films, the PSAs, then they would see them in classrooms and talk about them. They had puppets so they could act it out. They could start thinking about problems they had when they were mad at somebody and didn't like them, and use the puppets to act out their own conflicts. And it's now about 7 years since it's been fully implemented, it's in all the preschools there. And the research study that came out a year ago showed that it was starting to have a big impact. They've developed other PSAs since then. There's one on physical handicaps, where kids are, you know, figure out how to react to that difference. There's one on race, where they learn how to about people of color versus themselves, and they're all very simple little childlike stories where they become friends at the end. And the classrooms have had training to develop a whole conflict resolution violence prevention program in the classroom that goes well beyond the conflict between the Catholics and Protestants in Belfast. So the whole society has really made a commitment to working on these issues. But I will add that a lot of my work there is helping them deal with the impact of media and the kinds of technology and toys and gender stereotypes that we started the program talking about.
Oh, that's interesting.
That is a global phenomenon. I have been in places all over the world to help them deal with sexualization of childhood, with marketing violence to children, with the impact of media, which I call remote control childhood.
It's interesting you use the term PSAs, and I've been in radio long enough to remember putting together PSAs and how important they were. Mm-hmm. There just aren't even very many PSAs anymore on television, are there?
Because they can get money for ads instead.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yes.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Diane Levin, and she is the author of So Sexy, So Soon, The Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Children. She's done a great deal of work working with early childhood professionals for a number of years now, teaching courses on play, violence prevention, action research, and we just heard about her very interesting work in Belfast. She's done many projects. She's a longtime activist, founder of Teachers Resisting Unhealthy Children's Entertainment, which prepares materials to help parents deal with media and commercial culture. And she's going to be in Madison this coming Thursday, September 22nd, public lecture and demonstration. And this is sponsored by Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. The next day, there will be a luncheon for youth workers and teachers. And then this coming Saturday, a four-hour training session for early childhood professionals working with preschool children and their families. Here's our phone number if you'd like to join our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org, and lines and message space is available to you. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, starting with Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I generally share the concerns and fears of your guest, but I think she's barking up a dead tree. I think that the culture of violence is absolutely necessary for this country, because our country has become a militarized society. The so-called Washington consensus is that we essentially run the world. We have military bases, 700 or 800 of them around the world, so we occupy the world. Capitalism is our religion, and it generally comes out of the barrel of a gun, even way back as far as the Monroe Doctrine. I consequently believe that the kind of acculturation of violence is necessary to promote that kind of cultural understanding and conduct. So I think there's got to be some sort of cataclysmic change in our outlook in order to alter our direction. There's no hope that I can see at all. Thank you.
All right, Diane.
Well, there was a lot there, and to say that our society has problems that is contributing to us going down a road that works against what I'm talking about, it's hard for me to argue with. But at a personal level, what I'll say is when I started doing this work, I thought I was going to create the world that was best for children, and I no longer think that. Now, on a good day, I try to make it a little better than it otherwise would be. And on a bad day, I try to make it a little less bad than it otherwise would be. And I feel like there's a huge amount we can do to help children and families and teachers make it better right now in their situations. And I founded a group like Teachers Resisting Unhealthy Children's Entertainment, Truth. And I wanted to mention people can go online to truceteachers.org to get the guides on play, media, baby play, et cetera. That we prepare to help parents. And another group that really has had many successes working on change is called the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood, which I was a founder of about 11 years ago, and which someone else runs, but I'm involved with. And it has filed complaints with the Federal Trade Commission that have led to change. The Federal Trade Commission can no longer regulate, but they can make recommendations that have changed some of the way, some key ways, you know, that some companies have marketed to children. So I totally agree that it's an uphill struggle, and that one needs to ask why is all of this violence being marketed to boys, especially, and socializing them into a culture of violence, and why are girls being sexualized and socialized into a culture of kind of a sexist culture that really kind of diverts their attention from what would be most fulfilling for them and for society. And I have to say, that we're not going to make it perfect, but I do feel that we can learn a lot about how to make it better.
Much too large a question, I know, but take it at a small part if you'd like. What is the best world for children?
Okay, so the best world for children. I tend to think right now that children are developing two completely separate compartments in their heads. The pop culture world, which is talking about the messages that kind of contains the message I've been talking, buy, 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 look right, buy right, you know, be ready to fight, you know, those kinds of messages that are not the ones that we want. They have another compartment that's all the things parents, schools, society wants children to learn to grow up to be happy, fulfilled, caring, contributing members of society. And right now I feel as if the pop culture compartment or culture is getting bigger and bigger, and our culture is getting crowded out. So there's this huge clash of cultures. And what I will be talking about is thinking, you know, in terms of what to do. How can we make that pop culture compartment as small as we can and the societal culture compartment as big as we can? And in part, we do that not by locking kids up in a hermetically sealed room for their first 18 years.
Oh, why not?
Some parents tell me they would like to be able to do.
Exactly.
But it's how do we help them connect. How do we make the pop culture compartment as small as we can, but at the same time connect the boxes, connect the two cultures or compartments? So when a child comes home and says, Mommy, 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 I need to get this something or other that someone else has. It's so cool and everybody wants it. Or a little girl who was having a Valentine's Day party last year in first grade and she wasn't in school the day before, and her teacher, when she was in school Valentine's Day, said, oh, we're so glad you were back. The kids were worried you were sick and you wouldn't be having your party. She said, oh, no, no, I had to get my nails done.
Oh.
My nails and hair done for the party. And so all the other little girls went home and didn't want to go to the party unless their mother was with do their hairs and nails. I mean, that kind of pressure, how at that point do we talk to kids? How do we help them? Well, tell me why you want it. Here's why I don't want it. You know, we usually try to either, I mean, often we get angry, we get freaked out. Kids learn that. They don't come to us. So it's how do we stay connected with children and help them deal with it? And that's how they learn about connected relationships, which we want them to learn, and that's how they learn about gradually becoming part of both worlds, which is where they're going to be when they grow up.
Yeah. Jeremy in Minocqua. Hi.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you very much for taking my call. I have a little bit to say as well, and I'll try to get through it as quickly as possible. As far as what we were talking about with the girls being so sexy so soon, I agree with the guest in her statement, and I think that part of it comes back to an old adage. My father called it common sense, and I think that's where a lot of it is with the girls, because we put these outfits on them, and when you're 6 or 7, it's cute, but when they're 16 and 17, it's not so cute. And I think that's where parents just need to use a little common sense in how they dress their children. But as far as the boys go, I disagree with the guest a little bit, because, I mean, I grew up with G.I. Joe. I grew up with Batman. And I guess, again, it just comes with having that role model in your life to help shape you correctly. I grew up and, you know, went on to go to college, you know, to get into criminal justice and, you know, to help people and to benefit people's lives. And unfortunately, we do live in a violent world. And I think that a lot of it, as far as the media, I don't think the media is shaping the children. I think the children are shaping the media because they respond to this. And they respond to it because that's how we're wired. Boys are wired because that's what we do. I mean, we're geared for that kind of stuff, and that's what we want our men to do. We want them to grow up to be men, and we want them to do good things and to help protect our world. And that's, you know, I'm glad that people, you know, learn these things at a young age and grow up and go into the military and law enforcement and do good things with it. I guess it comes back to, there's always going to be people that grow up to kill and other people grow up to catch them.
Diane, thank you very much, Jeremy, for your call.
Well, several important issues were raised by Jeremy. One is, when we think about girls and common sense, I mean, that certainly, I think parents can learn a lot more to make better decisions. But I've also seen the secret memos by the industry that say, put the blame on parents, put the blame on, they don't say it quite like that, I'm simplifying. But that's the underlying message. And in other words, so many people say, well, it's parents' fault. If parents just knew just didn't say yes and just had common sense and were good parents, we wouldn't have this problem. And I can tell you, I have interviewed hundreds of parents who are good parents who struggle daily with these issues. So we're not going to solve it just by parents doing it. Society should be supporting parents in their efforts rather than making it harder at every turn. Secondly, did you want to say something?
No, go ahead.
Okay. With the boy issue, we know for a fact that your caller, Jeremy, is actually the first, because he had the toys he said he had. He was kind of probably the beginning of post-deregulation when he was growing up. And so each generation kind of, everyone says, I'm not affected by it, that this is how I am. That's what people say about girls. Well, now they say girls will be girls. Of course they want to be pretty. But I taught a course in education, sexism in education, during the women's movement, and we knew that wasn't true. There were other ways to raise girls, so they didn't just want to be pretty when they were 4. But when it comes to boys, and the research tells us that media violence contributes to increased levels of aggression. It doesn't mean everyone who sees a murder is going to go out and kill. It means, on a scale of 1 to 10, if you would have been on a 3, now you'll be at a 4. It also contributes to increased appetites for violence. The more you see it, the more you want to see it. So that's how you get addicted, say, to violent video games. It also contributes to seeing the world as a more dangerous place, so you're more willing to use violence and be ready to fight because you think violence somehow threatening you, so you see the world as more violent. And that's just a few examples of what the research is showing. So we have to ask, you know, yes, there are situations in the world, but what are the best ways to deal with them? And is training a whole population of boys to see the world as a more violent place what we want to do? We see crime, you know, the kind of levels of crime rates. And I would say that our job situation would be much, much worse if we didn't put so many of our boys into the military as prison guards or prisoners. You know, we'd have a lot more unemployment to deal with. So in many ways, I mean, that I'm not wanting to take that argument too far, but the fact is we have a real serious, the fact that so many men view that as their roles, including being prisoners, which is skyrocketing. The prison population has tripled, I think, in the last 15 or 20 years. We need to ask, and since deregulation, we need to ask what's going on.
Thank you, Jeremy, for the call. Victoria in Appleton, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, this is a very good program. I just want to take a different turn with it. I think the advertising of pop culture to today's younger generation is fueled by Madison Avenue, and an example of that may be when the baby boomer generation was, a big generation still around, that Madison Avenue glommed onto that due to the numbers of that generation. And now I'm thinking of Generation X, Y, and Z out there, that maybe you've got Madison Avenue appealing to this wide generation as a throwback to the baby boom generation and the parents of the baby boomers. And maybe they're even, the parents are fueling, a feeling of nostalgia, as far as the products sold to children today, the Barbie dolls and all of this stuff. And I'm just wondering if that might have a correlation as to what's going on with pop culture advertising today, that there are people that, are, nostalgic, the parents that may be of the baby boom generation, nostalgia is having effect on how Madison Avenue is now catering to that nostalgic feeling to the parents of the generations X, Y, and Z. And I'll take my comment off.
Thank you. Thanks, Victoria.
Okay. Yes, Madison Avenue is involved. Yes, after deregulation of children's television, most of the TV networks fired their children's production companies and started getting their children's programming from companies that were linked to Madison Avenue advertisers and did it all as packages. And whole children's marketing departments were created at that point on Madison Avenue that didn't exist before. So that's absolutely right. Obviously, and what amazed me, before I even knew that deregulation had happened, but I started hearing from teachers they were having trouble with boys obsessed with war play in their classrooms and that they hadn't had problems with before. And I was trying to figure out what was going on. It was clear that the people who were developing the shows and the products were better psychologists, child development, cognitive development psychologists than I were. Hmm. They did so many things that plugged into how young children think. So they were like, for instance, transformers. Children at age 3, 4, 5 are interested in transformations. Like, how do you make Play-Doh go from a ball to a pancake to a snake? And transformers were the perfect violent toy that did the same thing. And every child I saw who got a new transformer toy used it that way. They wanted to figure out how to transform it before they played with it. As far as different generations, what one of the things I pay attention to a lot now is second deregulation generation parents. We now have parents who in the middle 80s were children who were the beginnings of all of this kind of marketing and focusing on marketing and buying and the kinds of toys I've talked about in gender divisions, which has gotten, even more extreme now. What parents don't always realize when they say, oh, I played with Barbie and I turned out fine, or I played with Spider-Man and I turned out fine, is how much more violence is in the Spider-Man movie now? How many more toys and products are there to get boys to be obsessed with it? How much more bigger the muscles are on the action figures for Spider-Man? And similarly with Barbie, how it used to be you play with Barbie and I made my own clothes for my Barbie like dolls. Now you need a different Barbie for each clothes. They have what I've come to call crotch skirts. The clothes are completely different, even though people were upset about them, when Barbie first came out. Now it's much more extreme. So, yes, it is a cumulative process. Yes, each generation of parents has had a different set of experiences that they bring to bear on their parenting. And, yes, marketers do try to take advantage of that and getting them to buy things and how they raise their children.
And has all of that simultaneously over those years, we've had a huge change in the role of women in this society, huge change in the number of women who are entering law school, who are entering professions that used to be male-dominated. Has that counteracted some of this negative media? What is the place of what's happened in society?
It's really interesting. I mean, that's really important that that has continued. I think during the women's movement, those avenues started opening up. Women started being socialized to be successful. And so women's expectations certainly changed, and their relationships with men in the workplace changed somewhat. We know there's still some, I mean, it's not perfect, but we know there's been huge progress. But at the same time, and what happened is women weren't paying as much attention to fashion. Fashion industry was suffering. They weren't getting as much as larger proportion of dollars to figure out, you know, from women, because they were rejecting that. And I say in some ways what's happened since the middle 80s is kind of corporate revenge against the women's movement. They figured out how to get women to be successful and buy, to focus on appearance.
Hmm.
And there's a lot of talk about the pressures on girls. I've actually, you know, done a little bit of media in the last 6 months where, you know, that's the issue we're focusing on, of what does it mean to have to be a high-achieving girl and be a skinny rail, or have an eating disorder and have all the right clothes and all the right makeup and the right hairstyle and focus on appearance, so that to be a successful girl now, you know, you're pulled in all directions. And it's amazing how well girls are doing considering. But then we also hear that, you know, half of marriages end in divorce now. What does that say about relationships, and what I said at the beginning about the impact on, you know, the kind of relationship, caring, connectedness of, you know, children growing up now to be young adults? We also hear about things like friends with benefits and hooking up, and
sure,
among younger and younger kids.
Yes.
Where, I mean, so, you know, those successful, competent girls are caught up in that too. So it's a really, I mean, I don't think we've adequately dealt with it, and I'm glad that there's starting to be some interest in thinking about what it means and how we can help girls not feel so much pressure.
Mm-hmm. Danea from Marquette, Michigan. Hi, Danea.
Hi, thank you. There are two comments I would like to make. The first one is that as to the question, what's the ideal childhood, I think the answer to that is one that lasts as long as is naturally possible. And I think that one of the ways that that could happen is for parents to take more of an interest in what that event in their children's lives is about. They, you know, it goes by very fast, and all parents know that. I think if they spend a bit of time looking into what is happening with their child during that period, it would help a lot. And the second point I would like to make is that I don't think they realize, you know, most people listening to this program would think, oh, yeah, I understand that, and I'm glad that that doesn't happen in our house. I don't think they realize how subtle the messages can be sometimes. For example, if a parent is helping a child choose what to wear, you know, a young child or an adolescent, and they say, well, why don't you choose this one? It makes you look a little bit more grown up. You know, that seems like a perhaps innocent message, but it isn't really if you look underneath it. And I think things about, you know, subtle messages about the child's weight, or if they're eating too much of something, you know, things like that can really impact a child and make a big difference.
Absolutely. I agree completely with what you said, Nia, that the I do think that it used to be easy. I mean, what you're describing has become much harder now, because parents are getting all kinds of things modeled to them about how, you know, what they're supposed to do and what their child's supposed to look like. But I know in many of my talks with parents, when I think about what can you, you know, how many of you say when a child comes walking out dressed, oh, you look so pretty? And most of them kind of look shocked suddenly, because they've heard me say other things, and they think, oh, my God, I've been doing that, you know, that is what I do, and I really should say, you know, that's not what I should focus on in terms of my daughter. So there's much of that kind of resensitized, I mean, becoming more sensitized and knowledgeable about the issues and what we're doing and how our kids are affected. And, of course, when I'm talking about it, it's like kids are along a continuum again. They're not at all at the extreme, so parents see the extreme. So when their kids are less than the extreme, they don't notice it. But it's much more along the continuum than it would have been 10 years ago. But the other thing, in terms of what's going on now, I teach a course here at Wheelock on the meaning and development of play, and I have my students interview someone over age 50 about their play when they were young. And my students are often surprised at how much they were outside. Grown-ups weren't involved. They didn't need to be involved. Bigger kids took care of littler kids. There was a whole culture. Grown-ups would call them for dinner. But other than that, occasionally something would happen where a grown-up would get involved. But basically, it was a childhood culture that didn't that worked pretty well. And kids didn't have lots of toys. They'd go outside bike riding. They'd play ball. They'd make up games. They knew traditional childhood games. And my students, who are usually between the ages of, say, 20 and 25, say suddenly they realize that their play was different than that, but then they look at children at 4 or 5 or 6 now and see how different that play is from when they were growing up. So, you know, what I'm talking about has been continuing to escalate, and it all does mean parents need new ways to be involved, need to think more about being involved. Their voice is probably more important now than in the past because there's so many forces undermining their voices. So everything that Tanea said, I agree with. But again, we should be creating an environment that supports parents, not making them have to be more and more and more skillful all the time.
Thank you, Tanea, very much for the call. Going back to something that was said almost in passing a few minutes ago, do you think that there is a problem telling a young girl, or any girl for that matter, that she looks pretty?
Focal point of one's interaction around her dressing. And probably, I mean, I don't think I've ever said that to a little girl. Now I have a son, I don't have a daughter. So I can't, you know, don't have the full range of experience. But I guess what I think is little girls look for our approval. I mean, young children look for our approval. And they see all constantly on the screen, it's constantly being modeled for them that they have to look right, and pretty is defined as being skinny. So a little girl who's overweight is already talking, as Tanea said, about she has to go on a diet at age 5, and teachers tell me
that's crazy,
talking about diet. So I would say probably as a rule that we should not put that in our vocabulary. When a child comes down the stairs one day and says, "Mommy or Daddy, do I look pretty?" I would say, well, tell me what you think. You know, look what you put on. How come you chose to put that on? You know, I would try to engage and not just do this narrow focusing on a thing which we don't deal with at all.
Yeah. When somebody says that to you, Diane, what's your response? Diane, you look so pretty.
Well, I can't remember. People know better than to say it to me. sometimes I'll say thank you. But I don't usually get any further than that. And, you know, I'm from a different generation. And so it doesn't, and I have a different level of cognitive skills because of my age and stage of development. And so it's not the same. So, you know, I'll say thank you. I have other bigger issues to fight with. But I think when we're talking about little kids, it's a much bigger deal.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest is Professor Diane Levin, professor of education at Wheelock College, co-author of So Sexy, So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids. Also author of, I think this is in preparation right now, Beyond Remote Control Childhood, Working Effectively with Young Children in the Media Age. She's going to be in Madison this coming Thursday, conference sponsored by the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, public lecture and discussion Thursday, September 22nd from 7 to 9 at Memorial High School Auditorium in Madison. And then there is a lot going on the next day and the next day for helping early childhood professionals work with preschool children and their families on all of these issues. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to a couple of emails now. This one from Kathy in Madison, who says she remembers being viscerally affected by ads as a child. She mentions Polly Pocket commercials, and she didn't just think, wow, that's neat. She desperately needed to have a Polly Pocket and felt her life would be incomplete without it. She struggled with his desire for stuff and clothes throughout her teenage years, and this so she decided that she would not expose her children to as much commercial television because of her experience with that. Is that fairly common? Why is it that a commercial can make you want to have a Polly Pocket or certain clothes?
Yeah, I mean that your emailer was very self-aware in a way that isn't always the case, but marketers know this. Marketers know how to create that kind of visceral desire. And that's why by middle school, that's Earl's favorite thing. I call it the first drug, shopping. A child sees a toy advertised on the screen and they see happy children in it. And they think, gee, if I get that, I'll be happy. And it's so much fun. And it looks like so much fun. And they don't think, gee, those kids are getting paid to look happy. They don't think, gee, yes, it is exciting, but it only does one thing, and after I've done it 20 times, it's going to be boring, and I'll look on the back of the box for then the next thing I want, or look on television for an ad for the next thing. So there's a whole range of ways that kids are kind of socialized into socialized into marketing, and they end up, getting this visceral high from the new present comes, they're happy, they have it, or the thing has been bought for them, and then they can't, then they need another quick fix. So
right.
They go to their next drug. It's just like the drug literature.
Yeah. For Elizabeth in Milwaukee, could you talk about whether there's a socioeconomic component to childhood exposure to media and the influence of that media, i.e. are poor kids more likely to be affected?
That is a good question, and the answer is yes. Because we know from research that they spend more time glued to screens than higher-income children, low-income children do. Children who are kind of in poorer communities, often the parents feel even less safe letting their kids out, so they're inside more. Often they have less supervision in what they're watching because the parent or parents are, dealing with so many things that television becomes a babysitter or computer or screens. So, yes, and also then those children, often their parents are not able to supply all the things they lust after that they know they need to be happy, or as many things as middle-class parents can, so that those children often lust even more and feel deprived, and it leads to stress between parents and children in an even deeper way. So, yes, income is really important, and especially in these times, as there are more and more and more children living in poverty, I would think that it's just going to become a bigger issue.
Mm-hmm. Andre in Green Bay, hi. Andre,
hello.
Are you there? Yes, yeah. Go ahead.
To me, I see the problem, plain and simply, as we stopped being parents. Now, I'm a father of four. I have a 26-year-old son, 24-year-old daughter, a 17-year-old, and a 15-year-old. And I'm glad to say I'm not a grandfather. It's because of the way I raised my kids. My kids weren't allowed to sit in front of the TV 24 hours a day. I limit their video game use. And when I started noticing the shows that MTV was starting to show, I mean, glamorizing teenage girls having babies, dropping out of school, and showing programs like Skins, it makes young girls look more familiar with them than it does their own home life. They want to be what they see on TV. They don't want to be what their parents are trying to lead them into because parents aren't there anymore. Dad's working 16-hour days. Mom may be working 12-hour days. And they're latchkey kids. They come home. They're able to watch what they want, wear what they want, go when they want, and there are 11, 12, 13-year-old little girls out there living this lifestyle that they see on TV.
All right, Diane, we have about a minute left.
All I want to say is I think Andre captures many, many important things. I think parents can make a huge difference in the impact that it has. He's talking about his children now at 11, and I would have looked at them when they were 3, 4, 5, and 6, and I expect some of many of the same things that he described now are going on, and yes. But again, I think that even many parents who do what he's doing have children who go to friends' houses and watch, so then they can't go to those houses. I mean, there's constant struggles and constant escalations, so that even, you know, just taking your child out of the house can lead to exposures even when you're saying no. So it's a complicated process. We can definitely make it better, and Andre provides an example of that.
Thank you, Diane, very much. Have fun this week in Madison.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Diane Levin, professor of education at Wheelock College. She is going to be speaking again Thursday, September 22nd. I'm having a hard time. September? It is September, and it's late in September, the 22nd, 7 to 9 at Memorial High School Auditorium. Contact Wisconsin Early Childhood Association for more information about the whole conference, which goes on for a couple days. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production. A reminder that Jim Lehrer is with us tomorrow to talk about inside the presidential debates from Kennedy-Nixon to Obama-McCain. I love guests who have that kind of long perspective on things. Tension City is the name of his new book. He's with us tomorrow during this hour. Thanks for listening.